Chapter 4. When, in the middle of the 20th century, Van started to reconstruct his deepest path, he soon noticed that such details of his infancy as really mattered, for the special purpose the reconstruction pursued, could be best treated, could not seldom be only treated, when reappearing at various later stages of his boyhood and youth, as sudden juxtapositions that revived the part while vivifying the whole. This is why his first love has precedence here, over his first bad hurt or bad dream. He had just turned 13. He had never before left the comforts of the paternal roof. He had never before realized that such comforts might not be taken for granted, only occurring in some introductory ready-made metaphor in a book about a boy and a school. A few blocks from the school grounds, a widow, Mrs. Tapirov, who was French but spoke English with a Russian accent, had a shop of objets d'art and more or less antique furniture. He visited it on a bright winter day. Crystal vases with crimson roses and golden brown asters were set here and there in the fore part of the shop, on a gilt wood console, on a lacquered chest, on the shelf of a cabinet, or simply along the carpeted steps leading to the next floor, where great wardrobes and flashy dressers semi-encircled a singular company of harps. He satisfied himself that those flowers were artificial, and thought it puzzling that such imitations always pander so exclusively to the eye, instead of also copying the damp, fat feel of live petal and leaf. When he called next day for the object, unremembered now 80 years later, that he wanted repaired or duplicated, it was not ready or had not been obtained. In passing, he touched a half-opened rose and was cheated of the sterile texture his fingertips had expected when cool life kissed them with pouting lips. "My daughter," said Mrs. Tapirov, who saw his surprise, "always puts a bunch of real ones among the fake, pour attraper le client. You drew the joker." As he was leaving, she came in. A schoolgirl in a gray coat with brown shoulder-length ringlets and a pretty face. On another occasion, for a certain part of the thing, a frame perhaps took an infinite time to heal, or else the entire article proved to be unobtainable after all. He saw her curled up with her schoolbooks in an armchair, a domestic item among those for sale. He never spoke to her. He loved her madly. It must have lasted at least one term. That was love, normal and mysterious. Less mysterious and considerably more grotesque were the passions which several generations of schoolmasters had failed to eradicate, and which, as late as 1883, still enjoyed an unparalleled vogue at River Lane. Every dormitory had its catamite. One hysterical lad from Uppsala, cross-eyed, loose-lipped, with almost abnormally awkward limbs, but with a wonderfully tender skin texture and the round, creamy charms of Bronzino's Cupid, the big one, whom a delighted satyr discovers in a lady's bower, was much prized and tortured by a group of foreign boys, mostly Greek and English, led by Cheshire, the rugby ace, and partly out of bravado, partly out of curiosity. Van surmounted his disgust and coldly watched their rough orgies. Soon, however, he abandoned this surrogate for a more natural, though equally heartless, divertissement. The aging woman who sold barley sugar and Lucky Louse magazines in the corner shop, which by tradition was not strictly out of bounds, happened to hire a young helper, and Cheshire, the son of a thrifty lord, quickly ascertained that this fat little wench could be had for a Russian green dollar. Van was one of the first to avail himself of her favors. These were granted in semi-darkness, among crates and sacks at the back of the shop after hours. The fact of his having told her he was 16 and a libertine, instead of 14 and a virgin, proved a source of embarrassment to our hell-raker when he tried to bluster his inexperience into quick action, but only succeeded in spilling on the welcome mat what she would have gladly helped him to take indoors. Things went better 6 minutes later after Cheshire and Zagrafos were through, but only at the next mating party did Vaughn really begin to enjoy her gentleness, her soft, sweet grip and hearty joggle. He knew she was nothing but a fubsy pink pig whorlet and would elbow her face away when she attempted to kiss him after he had finished and was checking with one quick hand, as he had seen Cheshire do, if his wallet was still in his hip pocket. But somehow or other, when the last of some 40 convulsions had come and gone in the ordinary course of collapsing time, and his train was bowling past black and green fields to Ardis, he found himself endowing with unsuspected poetry her poor image, the kitchen odor of her arms, the humid eyelashes in the sudden gleam of Cheshire's lighter, and even the creaky steps of old, deaf Mrs. Gimber in her bedroom upstairs. In an elegant first-class compartment, with one's gloved hand in the velvet side loop, one feels very much a man of the world as one surveys the capable landscape, capably skimming by. And every now and then, the passenger's roving eyes paused for a moment as he listened inwardly to another itch, which he supposed to be, correctly, thank Log, only a minor irritation of the epithelium. Chapter 5. In the early afternoon, he descended with his two suitcases into the sunny peace of the little rural station, whence a winding road led to Ardis Hall, which he was visiting for the first time in his life. In a miniature of the imagination, he had seen a saddled horse prepared for him. There was not even a trap. The station master, a stout, sunburnt man in a brown uniform, was sure they had expected him with the evening train, which was slower but had a tea car. He would ring up the hall in a moment, he added as he signaled to the anxious engine driver. Suddenly, a hackney coach drove up to the platform, and a red-haired lady, carrying her straw hat and laughing at her own haste, made for the train and just managed to board it before it moved. So Van agreed to use the means of transportation made available to him by a chance crease in the texture of time, and seated himself in the old caleche. The half-hour drive proved not unpleasant. He was taken through pine woods and over rocky ravines, with birds and other animals singing in the flowering undergrowth. Sunflecks and lacy shadows skimmed over his legs and lent a green twinkle to the brass button deprived of its twin on the back of the coachman's coat. They passed through Torfianka, a dreamy hamlet consisting of three or four log izbas, a milk-pail repair shop, and a smithy smothered in jasmine. The driver waved to an invisible friend and the sensitive runabout swerved slightly to match his gesture. They were now spinning along a dusty country road between fields. The road dipped and humped again, and at every ascent the old clockwork taxi would slow up as if on the brink of sleep and reluctantly overcome its weakness. They bounced on the cobblestones of Gamlet, a half-Russian village, and the chauffeur waved again, this time to a boy in a cherry tree. Birches separated to let them pass across an old bridge. Lador, with its ruinous black castle on a crag and its gay multicolored roofs further downstream, were glimpsed, to be seen again many times much later in life. Presently, the vegetation assumed a more southern aspect as the lane skirted Ardis Park. At the next turning, the romantic mansion appeared on the gentle eminence of old novels. It was a splendid country house, three stories high, built of pale brick and purplish stone, whose tints and substance seemed to interchange their effects in certain lights.
This is the end of disc number one. Please insert disc number two.